And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. And guess what? Thanksgiving, my favorite holiday, is tomorrow in the United States. So if you celebrate Thanksgiving, I hope you have a happy and a wonderful Thanksgiving. It's also, I can't believe this, it's the 6-year anniversary tonight of our show. I'm having a little trouble getting to the chat room, so I should be in there sooner or later if I figure this whole thing out. Our guest this evening is Jeremy Corbell. He will be discussing his great new documentary film, Patient 17. I watched it on iTunes, and I highly recommend it. It's a great movie. It's very well done. I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Before our guest, we have Alejandro Rojas with UFO Updates. And before I forget, I've mentioned a number of times on the show, even as late as last week with Lee Spiegel, that a friend of mine at an auction house had an early UFO triangle sighting. So I talked to her last week, and I recorded it. So I'm going to be playing that clip coming up when I introduce Alejandro into the show. A little housekeeping, though. I sent out a newsletter today. There is going to be some changes coming up. As I mentioned last week, I had bitten off more than I could chew with the Monday night of the Everything Else show. If I was retired, it wouldn't matter at all, but I do have to make a living, and I have a very full plate. It's actually overflowing at this point, so it's really, really hard and very stressful for me to do the Monday show. So as it is, I plan my shows on Wednesdays and stay home. You know, that's what I do as far as I take every Wednesday off to make sure I'm here so I can do that. So what will change? Well, first of all, we're going to be moving from the live stream YouTube to a larger live audience on KGR Radio, and that happens on December 13th. There's a chat room there for listeners as well as a phone screening system that I can use, actually. And so I suggest if you want more information, you can visit the website podcastufo.com. I will be making a formal announcement through one of my newsletters. And you can sign up for the weekly guest notices and announcements. It's on the right-hand sidebar. And you just have to pop in your email, and that's it, and confirm it, I think. When I first announced I was going to do the Everything Else show, some supporters were unhappy because my focus wasn't totally on UFOs. But I do have one more announcement, and that is I am going to mix in a different topic now and then on my regular podcast, podcast UFO shows, maybe once a month or something like that. I'm going to make sure the main focus of the show is UFOs for all those people who have been supporting me right from the beginning. I've been hearing from a lot of you lately, and thank you so much for your support. I really do appreciate it. Lastly, there will be some show breaks. And Alejandro is going to be joining me for the first 25 minutes. He's usually on for 15 minutes, so this will be great. He's going to be on a little bit longer. Then there's about every half hour or so there's breaks in the show. There will be music for you that listen to the show as a podcast. You'll just hear a little bit of music on the breaks. That's it. You won't hear any commercials or anything like that. I hope you all understand I'm trying to do this for the good of the show to gain a wider audience. And so that's it for me, and that's certainly enough, a lot to swallow. Alejandro, how are you doing?
Alejandro? I am doing well. Yeah. Sorry for the pause. I had to unmute.
Oh, you had to? Oh, yes, that's right. A mutiny. All right. Hey, Alejandro.
Unmute me.
Yes.
Oh, look, and I have a guest Like you said, it's a holiday, so family comes in.
I didn't
and
see
some
him.
Some people.
I see, like, you're going to have to move a little bit more. There he is. Who's that? Hello.
Hi.
That is my cousin, Jason.
Hi, Jason. Welcome to the show. He's on the anniversary Thanksgiving show. We got it all going tonight.
Yeah, when I began my paranormal adventures, he was my buddy, my partner.
Oh, really?
And
you can say sidekick.
No, more than a sidekick. Yeah. More like a partner.
Well, sidekick is good.
You blazed the trail.
All right.
And I went.
So I've been talking about this UFO triangle sighting. So, Alejandro, you don't mind if I play it in the beginning here before the news, do you?
No, this sounds interesting. I'm excited to hear it.
Yes. Okay. Well, here it goes. It's a pre-recorded clip. All right. So this is a pre-recorded segment, and I'm with my good friend, Kathy. Now, I have told this story a number of times, and I wanted to get it straight from her because you never know how memory works. But so, Kathy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Kathy, so I was at the auction gallery and I was cataloging, I believe, and somehow you saw that I did a show on YouTube online. How did that happen?
I believe it's something that, you know, John was telling me about. And I think you sent a link to somebody about something and I started watching it. And I thought it was pretty interesting. And I think I told you I had a very similar experience.
Yes, so that's why you're on the show. So you're not someone that normally pays attention to UFO shows or anything like that. But I remember you coming out to the gallery and said, hey, I had a UFO experience. So can you tell the listening audience exactly what happened? And first of all, start out, what year was that?
You know something, I was trying to remember that after I had spoken to you a little bit. I think I was 18 years old, right around there. It was like 1975, 1976, right around there.
Okay.
And we live in Ipswich. I was living there at the time. And we were going shopping to Beverly.
This is in Massachusetts, by the way, for the listener.
In Massachusetts.
Yep.
And there's a little shortcut that you can take. It's called Mill Road.
Mm-hmm.
So we would cut through there to get, you know, you didn't have to take like 1A or a highway. It was like a little back road. So as my mom and my Aunt Winnie, my mom just passed. She was 86, and my Aunt Winnie is still alive. She's 90. And I was with my cousin Judy, and we were driving down the road, and it was very much farmland. There were very few houses, and you got to this one spot, and it was a very, very open field. And all of a sudden, when we were driving, we were kind of noticing these three lights, and they were different colors, like red. I don't remember exactly the colors, but like I know a yellowish or red. I don't think there was like blue, but they were very, very bright lights shaped in like a triangle.
Now, what time of day was this?
It was night.
It was nighttime.
Pitch dark.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, it was pitch dark.
Mm-hmm.
And it was probably, I'm going to say, you know, probably 6 o'clock, 5:30, 6 o'clock. It was like more in the winter time, so it was dark earlier.
Yeah.
So we are going down the road, and we've seen these lights, and I kept saying to my mother, oh, my God, look, and there's an airport there, Beverly Airport. And I kept saying, Mom, oh, my God, look at that thing in the sky. And my mother's like, you know, be quiet. It's just a plane. I said, Mom, that is not a plane. I said, and it's very, very low. So when we got to the clearing of the field, my Aunt Winnie pulled over, and we rolled down the windows, and this thing was just like hovering. It was hovering over us. And there was, you could see like a shape, but not really a shape. It was like almost foggy. I don't know how to explain it. And I got out of the car. My mother's like, get in the car. And I'm like, oh, my God. And it was like literally no noise, no nothing. And this huge object was just hovering over us. Total silence.
Was it right?
No.
You know, the silence part. The silence part is the part that always gets me. So was this like right exactly over your car?
Right over the car. Like right over our car. And my mom was having like a nervous breakdown, and all of a sudden it just whew, and went.
Just shot off.
And so we would.
Yeah.
It just shot. It just left. It shot off. So we were like, "Oh my God!" Like we were really like, oh my God, what was that? And my mom was convinced, you know, oh, stop thinking it was something bad. And I'm like, Mom, there was no sound. Like, that was something really weird. Mm-hmm. So we went shopping, went about our business, and we're coming home. And when we came home, we went the same way. We were going really slow to kind of look. And the next day, it was on the front page. I believe it was either the Ipswich Chronicle or the Salem News that I was not the only, we were not the only people that saw that. Several people saw it.
Wow.
And it was on the front page of the newspaper. Somebody had taken a picture. I don't know with what, because we didn't have cell phones or anything back then. And it was a picture of this thing exactly how we saw it in the paper.
Excellent. Now,
so that's my story.
That is wonderful. Thanks so much. And I'm wondering if a lot of times you can nail down, you know, the if you can't really remember the year, that makes it tough. Now, I don't know if you can talk to your aunt and if she may be able to remember the year that happened. But a lot of times you can go back and you can research these things. And I'm actually going to pass this information along to someone that does investigation on triangle UFOs, because 1975 is fairly early. You don't hear of a lot of them that early. So
it was like 75, 76. It's right in that time frame because I was still living at home.
Yeah.
I talked to my aunt about it, and she said that she remembered the lights. And, you know, she goes, oh, yeah, I remember that. And we talked about it a little bit, but she didn't remember. Because I said, Winnie, where were we? Like, do you remember where we were going? I said, I know we were going shopping to Beverly. I said, but you, like, remember where we were going? And she said, no. And she goes, oh, my God, I can't believe you remembered that. That was our conversation.
Yeah. Well, excellent, Kathy. Thanks so much.
All right. You're welcome.
All right. And talk to you later.
Thank you. Okay.
All right. So, Alejandro, we're back. I don't know if you're muted again, but you want to unmute. So what did you think of that? That's an early triangle because I talked to Lee last week, and he said his 1978, I think it's when he had his, was early, very early for a triangle.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that is pretty early, although, you know, David Marler, who wrote the book on triangle UFOs, literally, he has some going back, I think, into the 1800s, so.
Yeah, that's right. I know in the beginning, but they were very infrequent, you know, after, you know, in the 70s anyway. I mean, I think there's only a handful of them.
Yeah, you're right. It wasn't until, especially Belgium, that they got really big. And you know what's interesting about them, and we've talked about this before, but is that it does seem the triangular sightings are more blatant. You know, out of all the sightings out there, when people report, you know, more than any other type of craft, the triangles are right over the car, or, you know, very visible. And I think that's fascinating. Now, I talked to Tom DeLonge about this, and it's funny because, you know, speaking about Tom DeLonge last week, you know, your listener asked me that question. But Tom DeLonge says that's the case because those are definitely all ours, because in his scenario, you know, they've developed this technology in order to keep the bad aliens away type of thing. But I don't know, you know, otherwise I've talked to people who have seen them who are certain that they're not all ours. And, you know, Bob Bigelow did a report with the National Institute of Discovery Sciences, and they determined that they're not ours at all. And so it's really hard to say.
1975, I couldn't imagine that we'd have that technology in 1975. And
see, that's a great point. That's a good argument. Even in the late 80s, when they started seeing them in Belgium, the technology that they would have something like that is hard to believe.
It would seem we would know something about it after all this time. You know, I mean, people like Stan Friedman will say, you know, a secret can be kept. But I really don't think if we had something military going all the way that far, it could be kept secret that long. Maybe.
Yeah. I mean, someone asked, well, why mention, you know, Tom DeLonge if, like I said last week, I'm not as interested. I am interested, you know, speculation, we all speculate, and he's got some interesting ideas, and that's what these all are ideas, I think, until we can prove otherwise. So even with Tom, I mean, it's an interesting idea, and it answers that question as to why they're so, I mean, Lee Spiegel's sighting was completely obvious, you know, right above all these police officers and everything. It was so blatant. And if they are ours, maybe that would be the case. You know, that reminds me, Jason's dad had a really cool sighting like that in Aspen. Do you want to hear about that?
Yeah, from Jason. Do you want to you want to say it, Jason? What happened?
Sure.
You're going to have to slide over a little bit.
Can you see him?
Yeah.
Can you see me? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Yeah, you do need to get near the mic for sure. Yep.
Okay. Hi.
Hi.
All right. So it was 1987, and we were living – it was actually in between Aspen and Glenwood Springs, a little town called Basalt, and he my dad told us about a situation that happened when – we were there in the mountains, and my mom and I had fallen asleep, and he was fighting the desire to fall asleep too. And then all of a sudden, he was woken up because there was all of the power went out, and he looked outside and he saw that the street lights had gone off. And keep in mind, this is a very rural area. This is not in a town. This is just kind of a little apartment building next to the highway and the river. And so one street light at the end of the driveway was out, which was uncharacteristic. He stepped outside, and he felt a sense of kind of – he felt light. He felt like static in the air. The short hairs on the back of his neck stood up. And he came out to look up at the stars to see that the stars were blacked out in the shape of a giant, more like a trapezoid, so like a triangle with the pointy end at the tip cut off. And he kind of talked about it like it was a giant star destroyer from Star Wars almost, in that, but that shape very slowly gliding overhead. And as it disappeared behind the mountain, it suddenly all of the power came back on, and that was the end of it. Wow. He went back inside and told us all about it in the morning. Yeah. Pretty exciting.
You do hear a lot of those cases where the power goes out, whether it's a car. You don't really hear too many stories where the power goes out, like in houses and things like that, but you definitely hear it when someone's car, you know, ignition stops. Many, many stories. Thank you very much for that. That was great.
Yeah, no problem.
All right. So, Alejandro, I know we've eaten up a lot of your normal time. Do you have some UFO updates for us this week?
UFO updates. Okay. Yeah.
Typewriter. Yeah.
Yeah, that was kind of the typewriter noise. And for those of you who are younger, what a typewriter was like a thing you would. Like a keyboard. It was the first keyboard. You know, I was thinking about something, too, and on a side note, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Is that who knew that, you know, you see the kids typing, and we're all typing all the time. When we were kids in typing class,
yeah,
you know, kind of thought, this is stupid. I'm not going to be like a secretary or something typing papers.
Exactly.
Or,
I remember feeling that.
Who knew we would be typing like that was such a big deal now? Now it's like, you know, it's a huge deal. We're all doing it constantly.
I can't write anymore. I tried to write a letter to this elderly woman that was my father's, you know, girlfriend when he passed away. Tried to write her a letter the other day. I can't read my writing anymore. I'm so used to typing everything. It's amazing.
Yeah, I'm the same way.
Terrible.
So, UFO sightings. Yeah. This is kind of cool. It's getting a lot of attention too, is that there's this group called the Data Duo, and they essentially take data and make visualizations with it. And they do some really cool stuff. And they do these competitions where they compete. So they take a set of data, and then they will visualize it, and then you can vote for whose you like, one or the other. The two people are a woman named Pooja Gandhi and a man named Adam Crahan run the site and do this challenge. This week or this month, they decided to do UFOs. So they went to this site called Kegel that has a lot of different data sets that they've put together. And one of those data sets are UFO sightings from 1960 to 2014. I went to look at the site, and it's actually from NUFORC, the National UFO Reporting Center, which is ran by Peter Davenport, who you've had on the show quite a bit. And I know you know him pretty well. But these graphics were really cool. They show kind of sightings all over the world and in the United States. One of the things I did with the map is I noticed, you know, you can't just take sightings. Where are sightings, the most sightings? And here's why. Because the most sightings are where the most people are, you know. And I took a picture of the United States at night. They kind of graphically show this so you can really see it. And sure enough, it lines up with their maps almost exactly because there's more lights where there are more people. So what you have to do, I think, to get more accurate numbers is to figure out per population. So divide, you know, like the number of sightings in a state by the population, and you can get how many sightings per person, and then you get, I think, a more accurate idea of where the hot spots are. So I did go to Kegel and got that data set that they used, and I ran those numbers to check that out and see where the more sightings per person. The interesting things that pop up, Washington pops up to the top, but that's where NUFORC is headquartered, and they do get quite a bit of press out there, you know. He's kind of in the Northwest. When they write a story about UFOs, they'll often go to Peter Davenport. He's like their guy, local guy to talk to, which makes sense. And so they get a lot of reports there. But when you look at the other states, Oregon's really high up there. I showed some numbers that I took from 2014, and you see Oregon was pretty high up on that one as well, which is really interesting that Oregon should be so high. My numbers that I did in 2014 were MUFON numbers, but they do correlate with Peter Davenport's pretty well. Other states that are pretty high up there are Arizona, New Mexico, New Hampshire, Idaho, Nevada, Colorado, Rhode Island, Connecticut, Utah. So the per population, those are some of the places that you get, which I think are more realistic as hot spots. But still, these visualizations that the data duo did are really cool because you can highlight the different graphics and stuff they have, and information about them will pop up. At openminds.tv, I just have the images highlighted there, but if you click on the images, it'll take you to the interactive visualizations that you can kind of play with and get all the data on. So they're really cool. And what's kind of funny is I wrote this story. Bustle wrote a story, a website called Bustle, and that's where I found out about it, and then I wrote more about it. But now these maps are popping up all over the place. So a lot of the media is picking up on these maps and posting them all over the place, which is kind of cool because it's, you know, it's one of the things, reasons why, and I mentioned her book, Cheryl Costa wrote a book about sightings and where they're reported. And her book got a lot of attention for two reasons. First of all, she did a great job getting out there and getting the word out about her book. But second of all, people want to know about UFO sightings in their area, you know, and that's what this map and her book allows, which I think plays well with the local press too. So yeah, that was pretty interesting stuff. What do you think? I know you looked at that.
Yeah, I did check it out, and it occurred to me, I wondered how, when you mentioned that, you know, Washington was a focus, Peter Davenport's located there, it also made me wonder about how easily accessed reporting sightings are, how much of a difference that makes. In other words, like if you did this very same thing in Europe, what would it look like? You know, what type of reporting centers do they have? And, or, you know, how can you report a UFO in, say, you know, France or places like that? So per country would be really interesting as well, not just the United States.
You would need some different data sets. So, for example, MUFON does have a pretty strong presence throughout other countries, whereas NUFORC, not so much. Canada, of course, there's Chris Rutowski, and I forget the name of his group, but they do a lot of reporting, collection, and analysis, so he's pretty popular up there and gets a lot. In France, of course, that's pretty much the only Western country where they have an official government agency under their space administration, essentially. So they get a lot of reports there, and you can go to JPAN, France's UFO organization's website, and they post right on the front page their statistics, some of their top sightings and stuff like that. So yeah, that would take a more a bigger effort from someone, but it's something that's probably worth doing. That would be really interesting.
Wow. So hey, I want you to have a great Thanksgiving, and I do appreciate, you know, your cousin and you stopping in for our show. Thank you very
much. Thanks for letting us.
Our pleasure.
Joining us. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Happy Turkey Day, people.
Yeah, that's right. All right, well, you take care. And I'll talk to you next week.
Talk to you later.
All right. All right, everyone. So that is that's it for Alejandro. Now our guest, I'm going to be bringing in Jeremy. Jeremy Corbell. He's an artist. He's a filmmaker. Does an excellent job. Extraordinary Beliefs is his website. And we got a lot to talk about. Jeremy, I hope you unmuted your mic. How are you, Jeremy? I still can't hear you, Jeremy. Jeremy, are you there? Don't tell me I lost him. All right, hang on, everyone. I don't see him. library. Okay. So the new Skype, I always have my Skype sounds muted. The new Skype does not have that option. I'm not too happy about that. Jeremy, can you hear me?
I sure can. How you doing?
Good. And I want to also tell the listener what dedication you have. You your internet went out, and you took your car and you drove somewhere on top of a mountain, somewhere in California. Thank you so much. That's dedication.
No problem. That's right. Yeah, I live really, you know, remotely out there in the Mojave Desert, and the only connection I have to the outside world is this tiny little 10-inch dish, and it was acting a little bit freaky, so I kind of drove up to one of the mountains we have out here in Pioneer Town, California, and I'm broadcasting in the middle of the Mojave from a mountaintop.
Wow. And you sound crystal clear, so I am excited about that. So, let's see, we had you on, I think it was... Wow, it's got to be like 3 or 4 years tonight. I don't know if you heard us announce this, but it is the 6th anniversary of the show. I can't even believe it.
Wow, congratulations.
Yeah. Yeah, it was just, I don't know, just I happened to look, and it was this night I talked to Stephen Bassett. He was the first person, the first guinea pig to be on my show, and I did a terrible job. It was not so good. So almost 300 shows later, here we are. And I got to tell you, I know just as much about UFOs as I did when I started. And that's that's nothing. Yeah.
We actually only know one thing about UFOs definitively. And that's really fascinating. That came from a conversation I was having with Jacques Vallée. He recently visited, and we were able to compare notes on elemental and isotopic analysis. And when he came out, we were talking about the one thing that is known about UFOs scientifically, and that is that UFOs represent a huge amount of energy in a small amount of space, and that has been proven to most people's satisfaction. Other than that, it's anybody's guess.
Wow. I have never heard it put that way before. Now, I know Jacques' philosophy on something along the lines that if it's just extraterrestrial, then he'd be disappointed, and or something along those lines. And, you know, I often ponder what the heck it is. I have no idea. And that's one of the reasons I love doing the show, is because there are so many people with, you know, ideas on what exactly it could be.
Yeah, I mean, he came forward with the extraterrestrial hypothesis in you know, originally, and then he himself abandoned that philosophy as new data sets became available. He was actually kind of arguing with Steven Spielberg back in the day that this should be something that conveys more of a multidimensional, or even what John Keel termed as an ultra-dimensional phenomenon. But, you know, we as the public were not really ready for that at the time when Steven Spielberg was making his movie Close Encounters. Mm-hmm. So they went with a more traditional approach. But then if you look at, what was it, the Indiana Jones Crystal Skull, that's when they showed the kind of idea of changing dimensions. So, yeah, Jacques Vallée was really came forward with the extraterrestrial hypothesis and then came forward with the other hypothesis, which right now is more accepted, or it is being embraced with the extraterrestrial hypothesis, which is that we're dealing with something that might be way beyond that.
Yeah.
Way stranger.
Yeah. When I met Jacques out in Phoenix back, actually you were there as well. I was standing in line with him at the hotel and I said just a quote that I say from my show, and I had not even heard what he thought about it. Unfortunately, I hadn't read any of his books, which I do plan on doing. Shame on me. But I said to him while I was in line, I said, maybe it's something we haven't even thought of yet. And he kind of chuckled, and he says, yeah. He says, I think, you know, that's kind of what's going on, probably.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, one of the most comical parts of our interaction was we're sitting at my ranch, we're watching the sunset, we've had this great, you know, kind of comparing of notes and ideas with the scientific analysis of what people claim are non-terrestrial, you know, parts. And as we're kind of watching the sunset, I think, you know, this is my chance, this is my moment. And I said, what is this whole UFO thing really about? And asked him a few very specific questions. And he kind of took a long pause and then just kind of turned to me and said, you know, I have, after all these, come to those same questions that you're asking now. And I just don't know the answer. And I just look at him and I'm like, well, that's depressing. Because I expected him to give me, you know, something, you know, like that he knew something. But I think that he is mystified by the whole experience as much as he knows new questions arise. And that's just part of the game here. But at the same time, we do know more now than we did before. And that's progress. And we want to maintain progress.
I was watching a documentary on UFOs, and there was a clip that was recorded, I want to say, in the 1960s for a UFO researcher was speaking, and I can't recall his name, but I really got a kick out of what he said. He said, I really think that we're going to find out, and I'm going to find out in my lifetime, yeah. You know, what's going on. And I think that's the misgivings that a lot of people have, is that, you know, we're actually going to find out, and it's a total mystery. And I don't know. I think it feels like we're close or closer than when I started 6 years ago, but I don't know. You know, I mean,
What does it mean to find out? You know, so that's something that I've grappled with myself. You look to people from the past who have walked the path that you're walking now, and see where the pitfalls are and what's already been learned, so you don't repeat history. So I can confidently say that today, speaking with you through Skype in 2017, that I do know more about the UFO phenomenon and just the phenomenon that includes UFOs. I do know more about it today than I did when I began. But most of that was about discarding my preconceived notions. So knowing more is sometimes just trimming away the fat of what you think you do know going into something.
That really does make a lot. I totally get that. I totally get that. And it's like you have to have a fresh slate. And it's always when you're trying to understand something and you have something already in mind, it's already tainted right away.
Yeah, I mean, to give you a concrete example of what I just said, is that when I first started in this field, I was sure these were saucers from other star systems, that this is a physical phenomenon, that it was hard craft coming in from deep space with certain types of propulsion systems. But clearly, over time, It's something that you do learn when you really listen and you speak with people and you get behind a little bit what it is that they're originally reporting. You know, you come to understand that this is something that is physical, but it is not completely physical, that there's a duality, you know, kind of like the Schrodinger's cat thought experiment, where there's a superposition of two things at the same time. This phenomenon seems to interact with human consciousness, mm-hmm. just like those experiments, you know, the double slit experiment as well in quantum mechanics.
Oh, yeah.
That there is some sort of relationship that it has
to the observer.
To us. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I don't know if you were you able to hear the clip of my friend talking about her UFO experience?
Yes.
So I don't know if you noticed, but she said when she looked up, she said, I can't really describe it. It looked foggy. I thought that was yes. really interesting.
So this is something that is reported with real UFO sightings all the time. When I was recently at Skinwalker Ranch in Fort Duchesne, in that whole area of the Uinta Basin, one of the cases that I'm documenting is a gentleman named Corey, who actually is tribal security. And he also described the craft he saw, which we documented and filmed. And he described it as having almost like a cloud around it, although it was only, you know, 20 feet off the ground. And then a friend of mine out here, he saw one in 1943. I mean, this was a spectacular sighting, chased by jets, hovering over a pool with a bunch of kids in it. The water seemed to get quiet. Everybody became still. He felt like he could hold his breath underwater forever, like a dilation of time. And he comes up and he says, I know it sounds impossible and I know it sounds crazy. The craft itself, it was like sweating. Huh. And he says, I don't know how to describe it. It was like sweating.
Wow.
And so there is this moisture or precipitation that seems to occur around it, which would be consistent with high energy states.
Did you say 1943?
Yeah, 1943.
Wow. So that was before what we consider modern ufology. You know,
absolutely.
1947. Wow.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Wow, that is interesting. Wow. And because it was not talked about at all back in 1943, did he have a clue on what he was experiencing, or did it take a while for him to figure it out?
Well, you know, it was more of an emotional impact, and he's a young kid. He was more enthralled by the planes that came in to chase this thing. You know, they were propeller planes. It was like this big deal for them to see these planes that they all have little toys of coming right over Los Angeles, over this pool. And that was kind of where I could see he picked up and was excited about it. But he only kind of deeply recalled this as he got older. Where I'm actually reaching out to the childhood friends that he had. We're trying to see if they're still alive, to see if they had the same experience without telling them the experience he had. But what he said was that there was no thought behind it. This was otherworldly. This was clearly not ours. And I think that is the experience that people have when they encounter something like this at close proximity. It's obvious that this is something completely foreign, completely alien to what you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Alien, not to say, I mean, that term, it's like
right.
My friend Paul Eno will say alien in the sense of the word.
Right, foreign. Right,
yeah.
It was extremely foreign to him, to the point where it wasn't human. But that, you know, that doesn't mean that we know the origin of this craft or this display that occurred. But that was the impression that he got, and that is a big point of this. That obviously these objects, mostly light, most reports are just light.
Right,
but these objects do in fact choose, in a way, who can see them the majority of the time. And that's kind of interesting. You could have two people standing right next to each other and one person seeing it, the other's not. I've had that mm-hmm. experience where someone is seeing one. I don't see it. I bring it into my viewfinder of my camera. And the moment that my camera captures this object, then all of a sudden everybody can see it with their eyes. It's almost like we deny it until technology shows us it's there. It's really wild.
Well, you know, I had a girl from the Ariel School Encounter on my show. She was absolutely fantastic. I've gotten so much feedback from that show. But
incredible.
She was saying,
case.
You know, she was four to 5 feet away from this creature. And then later on in the show, we were talking about the witnesses, you know, how many people witnessed this. And she said some people were right there and didn't even see it.
Right.
Which is really, really baffling, you know, especially with all really, the excitement going on and everything.
Yeah, but it's really common as well.
I know.
But what's interesting is when you do get the multiple witness, you know, and then you get from, you know, not only multiple visual witness, but a close encounter. And then if that's corroborated with high tech, for example, FLIR footage like we have in the 2004 Nimitz case that I've actually been working on for 3 years silently and quietly, and it started breaking with DeLong's announcement and then a couple other researchers. So that's great. So now you get a case like that where we have FLIR camera footage from the gun cam of the lead fighter pilot. We actually have lots of radar data, which I think people are fighting to get declassified right now.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got multiple types of technology picking up these objects in really high scientific capacity, right? Top technology. You have eye visual witnesses, people that actually see it, who are trained observers, who are engaging this object with a fighter plane. And, you know, and then you have, you know, all these other types of witnesses. So it's just kind of fascinating when you can get corroboration from multiple perspectives and sources that lead to a more totality of a picture.
Yes, I do want to talk to you about the Nimitz case a little more in detail later on in the show. But I also want to talk about your movie, which is actually out now. I watched it on iTunes, and I really, really enjoyed it. I have to hand it to you. You do an excellent job with production. It was very well done.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I mean, look, it's a colossal task. I'm a one-man show, so every frame you saw in that, I filmed, edited, directed, sound engineered. So films like that, they're great because you can put them out with absolute artistic integrity and just say, here is what I experienced. And that was my goal with my film Patient 17, which, you know, follows the work of Dr. Roger Lear until he died, turned out to be his last alleged alien implant removal surgery, but I continued it because I wanted a scientific analysis of Object 17 for Patient 17, because he wanted to know what was taken out of his body. You know, what was this thing? So thank you for saying that, and I appreciate it. And I encourage everybody to watch, you know, Patient 17. You can go to iTunes, it's on Amazon, Xbox, you name it. It's on it with pay-per-view. And just take a look. My goal was to lift the visual aesthetic of UFO cinematography. Just really simply, make a pretty film. But in doing so, I wanted to tell a story that was very humanizing. So I think anybody can appreciate this film. My mom likes the film. she's the most critical. So,
well, I want to talk about a couple things about the film. First of all, Dr. Roger Lear, what a gentleman. I had him on my show a few months ahead of when he passed away. I thought he was a very nice and kind gentleman, and I'm sure working with him, you can probably agree with me on that.
Oh, absolutely. He was, I mean, except for when he was pissed at me and yelling at me. He was absolutely a seeker of truth. He was a pioneer. You know, he was kind of a renegade. You know, to be a surgeon and to do this type of work, it really puts you in this strange category. People don't know how to deal with you professionally as a podiatrist. But, you know, he maintained the integrity of his work as a surgeon, as well as his work with abductees or claimed abductees. And, you know, look, there is a case for this that should be made. If we go back to John Mack, you know, head of Harvard Psychiatry, mm-hmm. He was clear. He wrote many books on this. He actually went and interviewed all the students like the one you had on your show at the Ariel School.
Right.
So basically, John Mack was a proponent that the abduction phenomenon was indeed physical. It was indeed real and physical to a degree in that these people that have these experiences, and he studied hundreds and did psychological exams. This is not a psychosis. This is not a mental disorder. This is a real phenomenon. So just take it from the fact that, you know, hundreds of thousands of human beings, if not more, claim abductive experiences by unknown, intelligent, seemingly alien in the truest sense of the word, beings. So we have to deal with that as a society. We need to take that serious because that is true. That is real. People are claiming that. And then when we go a little bit deeper into it, like John Mack did and almost lost his position at Harvard University, is, are these abductions physical? Are people actually being taken from their homes, from their cars, with missing time, and relocated for a period of time? Is that physically happening? And he landed on yes.
Which is really amazing. You know, right off the bat, in the very beginning of the show, you introduce patient 17. He seems, to me, just his character seems like kind of a rough guy. He's a big guy. He seems like someone, like the last person you would think that would ever talk about something like this.
Yeah, he was. This was the selling point for me. I told Dr. Lear that I didn't have any experience in this area of ufology, that in fact I'm really skeptical of it, and that if I found that he was twisting the data or deceiving the public in any way, that I was going to out him. And I said, are you sure you want me to come and film your surgery? And he kind of got pissed at me, and he was like, yeah, Jeremy, I'm sure. I've been doing this for over 2 decades, and there's something to it. And I was like, all right, man, well, I'll do it. And you can kind of see that in the movie. There's some dry humor in there. I found it hilarious. He was using a stud finder and actually misusing.
He's going to talk
misusing.
About that.
Yeah, he was misusing a stud finder on a guy's leg to search for an alleged alien implant. I was like, you can kind of hear me under my breath say, but you guys have actual optics, right? And they're like, yeah, we've got ultrasound optics. We'll find out exactly where this is. We're not going to guess. And I was like, oh, man, thank God. So there was some humor in it at first for me. I was like, come on, this is crazy. But then with patient 17, he is stoic. I kind of describe him as, you know, one of the cowboys of past. He's soft-spoken, and there's no insanity in his family, and he's healthy as an ox, as he says in the film. So patient 17 was really the reason why I stuck with this, because there was a circus going on. I mean, the waiting room got filled with people just trying to get a glimpse at this, like, poor man and the surgery he's undergoing, and he wants to maintain his anonymity. That's why we call him patient 17. And that day I kind of shielded or blocked for him. And I think that kind of bonded us, because he saw that, you know, that I cared. And then knowing him, getting to know him, the way he describes his abductive experiences, which, let's differentiate, he knows to be real. That is not under suspicion. He had abductive experiences. He believes that. He knows that. But he was not sure that this object being removed from his leg had anything to do with his abductive experiences. So he was just as curious as me and just as skeptical as me to find out what this was that they removed from his leg.
Right, right. You know, something I've said on this show before, if this was happening to me, like I was having an abduction experience, I don't know how I could function in everyday life. I mean, it would just be, I could only imagine it would be totally consuming.
Yeah, you know, we partition elements of our life. So depending on how much this is really encroaching upon your typical everyday life, you know, I'm happy to report, you know, patient 17, he likes riding motorcycles. He has a wonderful wife, a wonderful life. He's got a great job. He likes to, as I said, like dirt bike and camp and that sort of, kind of like what I like. And he's just a normal guy of extraordinary height. He's 6'9", kind of megalith of a man.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, he's a big dude. You know, I call him my giant friend. So if I ever got to go bang on a door to find an implant again, he's with me. So, he just likes to have that normal life. And then there are these moments that will come from left field like a curveball and make you wonder what's going on, because you're left with two options. One is that this is not happening to you, and you're crazy. And that's very scary for people. And then, you know, the other option is this is happening to you. You're not crazy. But does that make you feel any better?
Right.
Yeah. So it's a pickle.
Yeah, really is. Yeah. I have to say that I can't watch anything to do with surgery. So a little
and I've heard that.
I want to not do any. I'm going to try not to do any spoilers, but I will tell if anyone else is planning to watch this and feels like I do, when you see it happening, just skip ahead to 16:30. That's the time you want to skip ahead to.
No, man. You got to pry your eyes open like Clockwork Orange style and force yourself to watch it, because it's real. You have to appreciate what this man decided to let happen to him, what he decided to do. I mean, that's part of it. And, you know, there are people, I've heard a lot of that from the film. That's why in my trailer, I give it to you front and center. So if you watch the trailer for the movie Patient 17, that's as bad as it gets. I mean, you're going to see it. And, yeah, man, we live in meat suits, and sometimes they're cut open to retrieve things, apparently.
Yeah, yeah, right. So he called them, you know, I guess I'll just call him 17 since he's, you know, anonymous. So he called them alien gangsters. Can you talk a little bit about that and why he called them that?
Yeah, I thought that was fascinating. That stems from a question I asked him. There's a scene in the movie where he's kind of working on this little motorcycle he has and sits down and gives me this interview. I went to go see him after the surgery just to see his state of mind, you know, what he's feeling, because everybody kind of abandoned him after this. So, you know, I went to talk with him and I said, well, tell me more about your abductive experiences. You know, what do you think about these beings? You know, what do they want? And he says, I don't care what they want. I treat them just like any other intruder. It's not like they come over and with a case of beer and pizza and say, let's have a bite and drink. And they're not, you have not invited them in, he said. He says, so, and he thinks about it, and he pauses. And this is a pretty powerful moment in the movie. He kind of pauses. He goes, well, they're gangsters, alien gangsters. They do what they want with you, and they discard you. And that's how he feels about it. If he gets a chance, he will take one of them out. And that's he's right. Serious about that. Yeah. He's fought back before in his abductive experiences. He has fought back before.
And a lot of people will claim, you know, you hear them say that they absolutely have no control, but he was saying he sort of broke free from that a little bit.
Yeah, and he was kind of surprised. You know, you could feel and see in the movie, you can see his surprise when he talks about it. He's like, it's like he had a revelation when he was telling me. He goes, yeah, so I guess that they do give you this control, this mental control they have over you. He goes, but I was once able to break that, and you know, to try to defend himself and, you know, tackle one of these beings, you know, and that was, you could see it kind of dawn on him that he could fight back. So he did have one experience that he was able to physically move and maneuver to end the abduction.
Wow. Yeah, amazing. So we have some questions that came in. I wanted to make sure that I didn't forget them, and so some of them are based on, you know, the object themselves, the object itself. And I don't know how you feel about what you want to give away, you know, as far as like spoiler, as far as the movie itself.
Nothing's really going to spoil the movie. Okay. I can talk about it all day long. There's no experience like watching it.
Right, right. So one of the questions here was, having your film Patient 17 mass distributed, does this give you a better opportunity to make other films? Is there a negative aspect to this with more pressure on for you to produce films for deadlines and not have a full artistic ability or control?
That is a fabulous question. Well, first of all, whoever wrote that, I'm really grateful. That brings up a very important point. So the first part of the question is, having this film mass distributed absolutely opens the doors for me to get more work out to the public. And as you might know, I'm sitting on a lot of work. You know, six years with John Lear, the full Bob Lazar film almost filmed with Bob. I announced that a little while ago. I'll talk to you about that. I mean, that's after 30 years. George Knapp, my mentor in journalism, you know, brought him out almost 30 years ago. I think he's 28, 29. So Dr. Edgar Mitchell, Sixth Man to Walk on the Moon, I was the last guy to film him 3 days in his home. I have an archive that's unbelievable that I want to get out to people. And having Patient 17 mass distributed has opened the doors for me to get films out to people in ways that I've never been able to do before. So that's the first part of the question. Yes. Second part of the question, does that in any way pressure me with deadlines or infringe upon creative control? Now, this is really important. The reason why Patient 17 took so long to get out to people was because I said no to everybody that wanted to buy it. Everybody. Because they wouldn't give me final cut. Imagine that. Yeah. They wouldn't give me final cut of my own film that's already done. Mm-hmm. They wanted to have the control to change it. So I said no to everybody. Didn't matter how much they offered me. Great thing about working with The Orchard is it's in my contract. I have complete creative control. Complete. So anything you see come from me will not be tainted by timeline, will not be tainted by pressure or creative control. It will be a one-of-the-kind Jeremy Corbell film. I take responsibility for every frame. And now I'm just able to get it out to you faster and better.
Excellent. Excellent. So let's walk through the film a little bit. So it goes, so I already talked about the surgery. So this thing has been extracted. It was actually put into a solution that actually came from, I think, from blood of the of patient 17. Or
yeah, it's a serum of his blood cells, yeah. So they spin it down, yeah, for yeah, preservation.
Just to keep it fresh. You know, the first thing that pops in my head right now is, do you know where the object is now? Because I know, I know when I spoke with Roger before he passed away, he said, I asked him where he kept these things, and he said, very safe.
Yep.
And do you know where the object is?
I do. And in fact, the film has applied some pressure to that situation. So you'll see in the film that there is a real point of contention at one point,
right,
about being able to study the object, object number 17. And I believe that over time, and also just the pressure of the film, I can now say that I have a good relationship with the custodian of this object, and that we have now access in order to study this scientifically and with the right mechanisms, that you know, the right types of scientific analysis. So that is in motion right now. It's a matter of getting the right tests and applying the same techniques to see if we get consistent results. So yes, I know where the object is, and yes, I'm supposed to have direct access to it at any time. So now let's see what happens in 6 months, right?
All right. Wow. There was a question. I can't see it right here real quickly, but the gist of it was when that item was extracted from patient 17, was there any difference in the way he felt? Because he does mention of him riding on his motorcycle, how all of a sudden he had excruciating pain there and had to actually pull over and lay down on the side of the road. Has anything changed with him since that was extracted?
You know, that's a very difficult question to answer, because you have to think about it from a psychological standpoint. You have these traumatic experiences, and we do compartmentalize them. Like, if you have PTSD, you're walking around 99% of the time okay, and then you have a flashback, you have a bad problem, stress-induced. So it's hard to determine, when you've had traumatic experiences, if the mental effects of simply change and having something out of your body, do you question if maybe it was doing something good for you? So I would say that patient 17 has gone through a range of emotions and experiences since the object was removed from his body. Now, from a toxicology standpoint, I was able to show a nanotoxicologist from UCLA the analysis of the sample, and he was like, it's really good you got this out of his body. It has arsenic, it has yttrium, it has all these toxic alloys. It's good you got it out. So any way you want to argue it, this was something that contained toxic alloys and should be removed as a foreign body from a man's, you know, leg. Absolutely. But patient 17 has gone on a roller coaster of emotions. Ultimately, he's loving life, as I said, has a great wife, great job, great life, and we're friends. And we get any chance we get, we hang out. And yeah, he's doing great, but we still want to get answers of what precisely. We know what it was, elementally and isotopically. We need to retest it multiple times to satisfy scientific rigor. But we know what it was to a degree. But we want to find out more.
Yeah. I know, I think somewhere in your film you mentioned, you know, retesting is important. Or Nanoman, I think, said something about that. And we can talk a little bit about Nanoman as well.
Yeah.
But Dr. Roger Lear is now gone. Is there anyone that is planning, as far as you know, to take over what he was doing and work with these so-called... All right, everyone. So thanks so much for listening. That's it for the free show. And we'll be back next week with Jim McDonald. That should be interesting because he is a skeptic on the Betty and Barney Hill case. All right. So have a great Thanksgiving if you live in America. Well, you can have a great Thanksgiving wherever you are. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.